Thank you very much for the opportunity to speak to your conference. You have an impressive program of technical sessions and poster presentations, and it's an honor to be here to help you launch the conference. I'm going to talk to you about microelectronics and its important role in the future of instrumentation and measurement. During my own work life, I've had many different jobs involving aspects and applications of physics, electrical engineering, and telecommunications. But my last 5 years at the Canadian Microelectronics Corporation have in many ways been the most educational and stimulating of my career. Microelectronics is a booming business. It's characterized by change. Change not only in technology, but also by the ever-changing range of applications in microelectronics, and now it's the very business environment of the microelectronics sector itself that's undergoing a quite remarkable restructuring. Back in 1978, almost a generation ago, two of my colleagues and I at Bell Northern Research wrote a conference paper entitled The Home Computer, Toy or Tool. In it, we recklessly predicted, amongst other things, the growth of the internet, the information economy, and the cottage industry and software. But of course, we got the fundamental question completely wrong. The personal computer, as it's now known, has become both a tool and a toy. And it's the influence of the consumer market on the microelectronics business as a whole that has today become absolutely critical to its future. In your field of instrumentation and measurement, you're very tightly coupled to the microelectronics sector. So in my remarks today, I'm going to discuss the major influences that, as part of my job at Canadian Microelectronics Corporation, I see driving the future of microelectronics and of its spin-off technologies. And I'll make some more reckless predictions about subsequent developments in the many different applications of instrumentation and measurement. But first, a few words about my own perspective on this scene. Many of you may not be aware of Canadian Microelectronics Corporation and what it is we do. We're a not-for-profit corporation founded in 1984 to make sure that at Canadian universities, professors and students could get access to high-quality microelectronics technologies. To do this, we provide high-end computing equipment and industrial-quality design tools, manufacturing services for prototype quantities of chips, and as much test equipment as we can afford. To this, we add design kits made up of technology files and cell libraries, plus training materials, tutorials, and online support. Our goal is to get new users, whether they're faculty or students, past the initial threshold of complexity and cost in developing and applying integrated circuits. And our services are free to qualified researchers in Canada. Our principal sponsors are the Canadian federal government through the Natural Sciences and Engineering Research Council, and Canadian industry through our 17 member companies and many other supporters in the business community. Today, we have 35 universities or research institutes as members from all across Canada, many of them performing top-quality, world-class research in microelectronics and its applications. And I'm very pleased that some of the researchers are with us at this conference. Our goal is to support the kind of research that's going to be relevant to Canadian industry. We rely heavily on what our industry members tell us about upcoming trends and their particular interests and priorities in microelectronics. And we do our best to guide our university partners into these areas. Our country needs leading-edge research into topics that are important to the future of Canadian industry. And it needs students trained in the areas and the skills that will make them very productive when they graduate into the workplace. Are we succeeding? Today, there are over 1,000 researchers and students at Canadian universities working in different areas of microelectronics. And it's very enlightening to examine the types of research projects that are underway in our institutions by reviewing some of the nearly 1,000 chip designs that CMC, Canadian Microelectronics Corporation, has processed over the last 3 years. Since Canada is a country with a great appetite for telecommunications and many strong companies in the field, it's not surprising that the majority of chip designs address some aspects of communications technology. The emphasis today, as you might expect, is on low power consumption and low voltage operation for portability, also on devices that operate up to several gigahertz. But Canada also has a very strong resource and environmental sector, so we see many sensor designs, notably those that have to operate under hostile conditions in the ocean or deep underground, such as one recent chip we fabricated intended for an oil well drill head, which had to operate at temperatures well above 200 degrees centigrade. At another extreme, we see neurostimulator chips, which are destined eventually for implantation in the human body. And one set of designs recently for an integrated smart pixel system for robot vision led to a spin-off company from the University of Laval to manufacture the components. An even more ambitious project at McGill University, which is supported by a Center of Excellence in Telecommunications Research, is creating an optical backplane running at several terabits per second by bonding an optical device to the surface of a silicon chip. As you can imagine, it's not a simple task to provide hundreds of researchers and students with the capabilities to do this kind of work. For example, we loan out to our university members over 150 workstations, mostly Sun Ultra models, and the design tools we supply include a full suite of Cadence software and Synopsys synthesis tools, plus a number of special purpose packages for design and test. But it's our manufacturing technologies that are at the core of our services. You could infer from the project examples I just gave that Canadian researchers do a lot of analog design. In fact, about 80% of the designs we handle have some analog content, either being purely analog or having a mixture of analog and digital circuits. And for us, that means while we must provide fast digital silicon and appropriate design tools, we must also offer technologies with good analog performance and the necessary process information and models for design and simulation purposes. When CMC began in the 1980s, we made our chips using a 6-micron NMOS technology. When I joined CMC in 1993, our principal fab vehicles were 3-micron and 1.2-micron CMOS, complementary metal oxide semiconductors, plus a relatively low-speed bipolar array with a 2.5 gigahertz cutoff frequency. And these all came from Canadian manufacturers with in-house fabrication facilities. Today, our top of the line is a 0.5-micron CMOS with modest analog performance and a 0.8-micron bi-CMOS, bipolar CMOS, with excellent mixed-signal performance. We still offer our low-speed bipolar array, but now its principal use is for coursework, thanks to the manufacturer, Genom Corporation, who provide us with a one-week manufacturing turnaround. So it's now very feasible for a class to go through a complete design, fab, and test cycle in one semester. We've added a 14 gigahertz bipolar array for high-speed and radio applications and a gallium arsenide technology for similar purposes. We still offer a mixed-signal CMOS, 1.5 microns, which is our workhorse technology that's used for a number of different applications. One of these is as the platform for a bulk micro-machining service that we began last year. We're currently doing the engineering work, licensing, and financial negotiations to provide a 0.35 digital CMOS and a 25 gigahertz full custom bipolar technology later this year. We're negotiating to acquire cell libraries from commercial vendors for some of these new technologies. and we're going offshore to find suppliers, as do many of our industry members in Canada. And after all this work, we'll perhaps be one generation behind the digital silicon state of the art, since the leading practitioners in memory design are already creating chips designed for 0.2 micron technology. We expect the future is going to be equally challenging and fast-moving, and this means we must constantly look ahead to see what's happening in our industry and to respond to the changes in technology and to the business environment. And we have to make sure that these changes are reflected in the research and in the training that's carried out in our universities. So what are the factors that have made microelectronics such a dynamic business? Today you seem to get microchips with everything. The chip has arguably influenced our lives more than any other technology in recent memory. My son has access, at least potentially, to more information in one evening than his grandfather could reach in his whole lifetime. The microchip has virtually created modern computing and telecommunications, and it's creeping rapidly and insidiously into many other fields. For me, it's hard personally to remember that only 15 years ago, on behalf of my company, I spent $1 million for a big blue box to do chip design, and that box was capable of one MIP, 1 million instructions per second of computing power. Today, that seems incomprehensible when I can buy a personal computer with vastly more power for about $1,000, and I don't need dedicated staff to run it either. And while the roots of microelectronics are clearly anchored in the scientific and the engineering community, such as are represented at this conference, I must say that it is the consumer and the entertainment markets that today are providing much of the impetus for the investment, the innovation, the R&D that is keeping the learning curve of microelectronics rising steeply. I'm going to spend a few moments then looking at some of the factors that underlie these different developments. I'll start with technology. Silicon technology seems to have developed almost a life of its own. Each new generation of silicon chips serves as the platform from which its successors are being developed. The number of circuits on a silicon chip and their performance have doubled every 18 months or so for the past 30 years. This trend has seemingly been on a collision course with the laws of physics and the laws of economics for some time, but still the technologies that were expected to dethrone silicon have not yet succeeded. The robust oxidization properties of silicon make it relatively easy to manufacture reliable devices. Its compatible electron and hole mobilities make it possible to create complementary CMOS circuitry, and the low power dissipation of CMOS makes high density devices feasible. This in turn permits the integration of more and more functionality on a single chip, literally to create systems on a chip, and thereby deliver greater customer value onto a single device. And the economic payoff from this device can drive more investment back into the silicon technology. So any replacement technology must contend with a huge base of investment that supports the silicon manufacturing industry. Now it is more attractive to find ways to modify silicon technology to improve performance or create new applications than it is to launch a new non-silicon based material. While gallium arsenide and similar compounds will likely hold on to their established niche positions, it looks like silicon will not be replaced as the backbone semiconductor technology for quite some years. These developments, though, come at a high cost, and given the enormous investment expense of today's megafabs, you can be sure that their owners and investors are constantly seeking ways to use them as productively as possible, for as long as possible. One example of this could well be the expected use of silicon germanium for applications that need the speed of gallium arsenide. Silicon germanium can be manufactured in existing foundries with relatively modest capital investment. And another even more exciting example is the widespread use today of silicon manufacturing processes as the basis for micro-machining. Micro-machine components used for things like flow measurement and other sensor-based circuits have demonstrated that sensors can be integrated with electronic circuitry to provide cost-effective solutions for high-volume automobile applications. And there are millions of these vehicles produced worldwide every year. The auto airbag is a very good example of how more functionality can be integrated onto a silicon device while reducing cost and improving performance. Those original mechanical airbag sensors used rolling balls or cylinders and were basically crude switches. Their functioning was unreliable and binary. But today, micro-machine sensors are being integrated with digital circuits, either directly on a chip or using advanced packaging. The accelerometer sensor in the automobile now provides analog information, which is converted to a digital format and operated on via a digital signal processor to decide if or how an airbag should be deployed. This information can be combined with that from other sensors in the vehicle, if required, such as the weight of the person in the seat that's being protected. The smart Pixel vision system from the University of Laval that I mentioned is another example of sensor integration at work using a standard silicon process. The terabit optical system from McGill University is interesting in another way. It combines advances in physical packaging techniques to integrate a non-silicon material used for the photo device with a mixed-signal silicon chip that we are building for them. In fact, using packaging techniques to combine different semiconductor die onto multi-chip modules has become so effective recently that in some cases it's proving very competitive with full on-chip integration. That's one of the reasons why at Canadian Microelectronics Corporation we recently made the decision to discontinue our BiCMOS fabrication in favor of providing faster and more dense CMOS and a separate 25 gigahertz bipolar technology. Die from these two processes can be combined through packaging to give excellent performance in practice. And while we lose some of our mixed signal capabilities, our industry members are pointing out that because of the density of available digital circuits on chips, and perhaps because of the shortage of good analog designers, many analog functions today are being performed by digital circuits. So in summary, our message to Canadian researchers and educators is that silicon will remain as the core semiconductor technology of choice with no immediate end in sight for the continuing reduction in line width and power consumption and consequent increases in circuit density. In future, we'll see more systems on silicon chips and more chips which will include integrated electro-optical and electromechanical components. The niche semiconductor technologies like gallium arsenide will survive and will probably quietly prosper, but they will have modest market penetration on their own relative to silicon. But we will see multi-chip module packaging techniques being applied effectively and more frequently to integrate silicon chips with these other technologies, including displays. In my view, the profound influence on the microelectronics community today is the impact of the consumer marketplace. The pace of change in engineering and scientific products is slow compared to that of the consumer market. The personal computer market illustrates very well just how volatile this demand can be. In the customer's eyes, at least, this year's Pentium processor is obsolete by next year. And the popularity of peripherals like video cards is even more fickle. Nintendo was almost put out of business recently when its new game system was beaten to the market by a few weeks by Sony's PlayStation. And these kinds of dynamic high-volume markets emphasize new functionality, portability, relatively low cost, and above all else, speed to market. In effect, these customers want systems on a chip, and they want them fast. And this is forcing companies in the microelectronics industry to look for new ways to streamline their product cycles, and it's creating some very interesting new approaches to creating microchips. One simple approach is to use a widely available hardware platform and to customize it with software. One of my friends, Robert Hum of Cadence Design System, describes this as hardware by Grove, software by Gates. The constraints of using a standard hardware platform can often result in a suboptimal solution and, of course, in complex software with unpredictable results. Off-the-shelf hardware means limited competitive advantage as well. So another, slightly more customized solution exploits the flexibility of field-programmable gate arrays. These are very useful devices. They allow digital circuits of medium complexity to be configured very rapidly. They're well-suited to prototyping and even to small-scale product runs. Today, we're seeing field-programmable systems on a chip called embedded arrays. And these allow the rapid interconnection of different functional modules, for example, processors, memory, and IOs, in the same way that digital circuits can be connected on the field-programmable gate array. Once more, however, these field-programmable devices have disadvantages. Their flexibility is limited, and they're very expensive to use in any quantity. You can be sure that the custom integrated circuit community is not ready to let Intel or Microsoft take over their businesses. They believe that the advantages of purpose-built hardware far outweigh any disadvantages, especially if the industry can solve the time-to-market challenge. Major fabs are already offering improved fabrication turnaround times, especially for initial runs. And one large design tool company, Cadence Design Systems, is restructuring its operations to offer design services, services capable of turning around sophisticated new custom chip designs in the target time of 1 week. Cadence wants, for example, to do the designs for toy companies that need to respond to the next Tickle Me Elmo doll next Christmas. And Cadence planned to do this by integrating reusable components from previous designs onto new chips, in much the same way that discrete components have been placed on a circuit board. This technique is not fundamentally new, since designers have been able to reuse existing libraries of virtual components from a single manufacturer for some time. But Cadence wants to take the concept further by creating an intellectual property market for reusable design components, which could be obtained from a wide variety of sources on a just-in-time basis, perhaps over the internet. While this approach is technically very feasible, it's going to require at least a de facto set of standards which will permit the easy integration of these virtual parts. Cadence and a number of other companies have launched the Virtual Socket Initiative, VSI, to try and kickstart this process. And it's one example of the major shifts in thinking that are taking place in the global microelectronics community as it reacts to the new dynamics of the marketplace. And as you may imagine, it is placing all kinds of new demands on the skills of the people working in the industry, who themselves have got to adapt very quickly to the new situations. At Canadian Microelectronics Corporation, we are hedging our bets because we believe that in reality there will be many different solutions, and they'll include elements of those that I've described. We expect to see, for example, extensive use of standard hardware cores in designs, of embedded software and custom hardware, probably all in the same devices. And with these kinds of hardware-software co-design requirements in mind, we're currently field trialing a platform for digital signal processing research that allows users to explore the different hardware-software configurations. The platform is based on a C40 processor core and a reprogrammable hardware accelerator. We hope that this will allow our universities to train the new breed of systems-on-a-chip designers that Canadian industry is going to need. Those examples that I've just given illustrate how the microelectronics industry is coping with change and reinventing itself to accommodate the rapid developments in technology, market, and costs that I've been describing. And these are not the only structural changes in the industry. Today, there are noticeably fewer vertically integrated companies with dedicated in-house fabrication than there were a decade ago. The investment required to keep pace with leading-edge technology is proving unattractive to all but the most profitable companies. And even these now are starting to offer commercial merchant services to offset their costs. IBM is a notable example. Many successful chip vendors today operate in fabless mode. They target their product designs into external foundries. And the foundries themselves, the pure play foundries as they're called, each represent investments in excess of $1 billion, and each have one objective, to make as many high-volume silicon chips as possible for as many successful customers as possible. So with these changes, it's now feasible for a company in any sector that sees a business opportunity requiring a state-of-the-art custom chip to contract out the necessary design and manufacturing work to specialist microelectronics companies and to achieve the kind of quality and turnaround time that they're going to need to win big in the marketplace. And the success of Sony's PlayStation product recently was an excellent example of this approach in practice. So there have been a lot of changes in the microelectronics community. But what does it all mean for instrumentation and measurement? We'd all agree, I think, that measurement and test are fundamental to all the sciences, to engineering and manufacturing, and that the instrumentation and measurement community has effectively exploited technology developments in microelectronics and related fields in the past. Products in your many fields today have greater functionality, greater portability, and greater flexibility than they ever had before. Many of the papers and the presentations at the conference address these themes in a wide variety of applications. So in the future, I can certainly expect to see more aggressive and more ingenious integration of sensors and signal processing, probably combined with displays and remote communication and networking capabilities, all in highly portable instruments. These products will be of high quality, high functionality, and relatively high cost. They'll address the usual scientific, engineering, military, and medical customers. And that's what I would describe as the business as usual scenario for instrumentation and measurement. But in view of the other trends in microelectronics that I've been describing, I'm tempted to speculate now about how the drive to fill those mega foundries by creating new microelectronics applications could create a much bigger market in the instrumentation and measurement fields. What products and services could stimulate high-volume, system-on-a-chip, consumer businesses for measurement devices? One market is already in existence, courtesy of the millions of vehicles manufactured worldwide every year. It seems each week I read of some new measurement device being offered for the automobile, such as a global positioning system-based navigation device. So I'm beginning to believe that there's a real opportunity to create markets in personal instrumentation. Of course, things like the digital watch already exist, but this marketplace has yet to be exploited with the energy that's characterized other innovations, such as the cellular phone. But the time may now be ripe. I read recently that there's a booming business in home medical diagnosis kits here in North America. I suppose this is a consequence of an aging population, the growing costs of medical services, and the very natural desire for people to know what's happening to them. But it's also an opportunity to provide improvements in medical instrumentation, not for the medical community solely, but for the lay person. I don't like hospitals or medical labs, and I would pay very well for the ability to diagnose my condition or monitor my vital signs at home, even if I still had to go to an institution for treatment. But perhaps you can help me there, too, with devices to administer medication under appropriately measured and controlled conditions. In the area of prevention, I would be equally interested in portable equipment to measure my personal environment. The water I drink or bathe in may be contaminated. What about the air I'm breathing? What about my electromagnetic environment? Is my waterbed, my electric blanket, or my microwave oven giving off low-level radiation at excessive levels? In a different context of health preservation, the growing market for global positioning systems suggests that personal positioning may be a very saleable item in the near future. Perhaps my GPS wristwatch will warn me if I stray into the wrong part of town. At home, my wife is a keen gardener and she grows some of our food. Could I measure the soil in my garden so that I can treat it most effectively, in the same way that farmers in the Canadian prairies are now tending to their crops? These are just a few simple examples of the more obvious consumer markets that I think could be exploited in the coming years as a direct result of the application of microelectronics and its related technologies in instrumentation and measurement. There are splendid opportunities to create integrated systems components, to create reusable intellectual property that can themselves help drive volume, instrumentation, and measurement products. And I hope that some of the work that you'll be discussing at this conference will contribute to making these new scenarios become reality. To sum up, I've talked about the remarkable developments in silicon technology, about the impacts of increasing investment costs, which have led to a growing emphasis on consumer markets for microchips, and how the demands of the consumer market are causing the microelectronics business to reshape itself to address the new challenges. And I hope I've also suggested some plausible outcomes and implications for the instrumentation and measurement community. I'll close by briefly returning to an issue that I've mentioned several times in passing, but which I believe is very critical to our future. This is the need to develop more skilled people for the high technology sector as a whole and for microelectronics in particular. The shortage of skilled people, people with appropriate scientific and engineering backgrounds, and I include intellectual property lawyers and investment bankers, is probably limiting the growth of microelectronics and its dependent businesses more than any particular technology issue. Because the demand for skilled people exceeds supply, the costs of recruiting and retaining the existing workforce are rising dramatically. And this is good news for those individuals already in the workplace, at least in the short term, but it's a real problem for our industry in the future. So while we carry on with the important technical work at this conference, I believe it is desirable that we also remember to look for ways to make our scientific and engineering contributions better understood by and have greater visible impact on the general public, whose lives and lifestyles we support so fundamentally. It's their understanding and enthusiasm that will help maintain active support for our research and development work and also help to attract more of our young people to work in challenging and rewarding fields like instrumentation and measurement. While we make our work more excellent through participation in conferences like this one, we must also make it more visible, exciting, and appreciated. Thank you very much, and have a most enjoyable and productive conference.